Welcome to the weekly Dharma Talk podcast from the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling Buddhist Meditation Center. This week, meditation instructor Jim Dunn explores Chapter 2 in our continuing discussion of the book Interconnected by His Holiness the 17th Jawang Karmapa. In this chapter, we'll look at the wise use and the misuse of the Internet and how it has brought us both greater connection and an increase in feelings of loneliness. His Holiness encourages us to find and cultivate deeper and more meaningful ways of being connected by developing a sense of gratitude and living a richer life. If you like our Dharma Talk series, please consider donating to Columbus Karma Teksum Choling at columbusktc.org. Enjoy the podcast.
Good morning, everyone. It's good to see people here in this heat and not out in the sun and having fun at ComFest. I'm Jim Dunn. Obviously, I'm not Lama Kathy. And she couldn't be here today, so when she's not here, some of us fill in, some of us meditation teachers. And we have been going through a book study. And right now we are on Chapter 2 of this book, Interconnected, by the Karmapa, the 17th Karmapa, kind of the head of our lineage. It's called Interconnected, Embracing Life in Our Global Society. And it's really not written as a Buddhist book for Buddhists only. He's really trying to reach a general audience and kind of bring some of Buddhist ideas into the general stream of thought, which I think is excellent. Although interconnectedness is a key part of our teachings. And usually we call it interdependence, but for this book, he thought about interconnected as being maybe a little more accessible or responsive to people, that interdependence has the idea of being dependent. And, you know, it's a good old American cowboy image as we all kind of carry. We don't like to be dependent, so connected is better. So that's partly why he chose the title. So this is part two. A couple of weeks ago now, Marcus gave talk one on this, the first chapter of the book. And it is online if you want to listen to it. It's a good talk. And just a little bit of review. He just kind of gets into the overall theme of the book of being interconnected, interdependent. Kind of pushes the idea of more engaged Buddhism, and acknowledging the way we are independent, interdependent. I guess we can sort of sum it up when he says, our inner world is the pivotal domain for bringing about real change in the world we all share. Neither social nor environmental justice is possible without significant changes in our attitudes and the intentional behavior they give rise to. The transformation of our social and material world must begin with us. Then he goes on to talk about how we need more than an intellectual understanding of this. We need to really bring it home and feel it. You know, sometimes in Buddhism when we're studying it, they talk about the three wisdoms, the wisdom of hearing the Dharma, which is what you're doing today, the wisdom of kind of thinking about it, contemplating it, and then the wisdom of meditating it. And just hearing it is a good start. Contemplating where you kind of get to understand it is good. But to really bring it home, bring it into your meditation practice, bring it into your lives in a more emotional felt way, is kind of at the heart of what we're doing. It's kind of what we need to be doing. Otherwise, we can have lots of knowledge and be able to talk all about it, but it really won't change a thing. And the idea of studying the Dharma, practicing the Dharma, is that it really should in some way change our lives. It should affect us in a way that actually makes us happier in the world and more comfortable, more at ease. So the real power of interdependence isn't just a theory, but it is a value that guides our life. This deep awareness of interdependence really can change lives and change the world. And it's a project of really living in accordance with reality. This is not an abstract theory. We sometimes talk about being interdependent, and we talk about self-made men. And really, we really do depend on each other for all kinds of ways. You know, if you have a business and you think you build it up all by yourself, I'm guessing you really didn't train and educate and teach all your employees how to read and write. You needed the school system for at least that much. And most businesses want a fair set of skills before they even think about hiring you. And if you're having a business, you need people to get to it, or you need to get your goods out to people, and you're not building the roads. So all of those things we are really depending on others for, and we're all really kind of connected together. So we really need to kind of give some thought to this and bring it into our life. Now the Karmapa chapter 2, where we are today, kind of brings in what he calls the paradox of our current age. With the internet, we are so connected, so interconnected. You know, we can get online and communicate with people pretty much all over the world. And yet, a lot of us really don't feel really connected. Loneliness seems to be a pretty big problem. A recent study, somewhere between 25 to 50% of Americans feel lonely some or most of the time. In England, Theresa May, a while back, appointed a minister of loneliness to try to deal with the problem. And they've done studies that loneliness really does contribute to a lowered immune system resistance, poor health, and shorter lives. And what was really surprising in one of these studies is that loneliness seems to be more affecting Generation Y and the millennials. You know, used to think it was old people living alone on their own. But apparently a lot of young people are feeling pretty lonely now, pretty disconnected. So we need to figure out a way to connect more. You know, and that is one of the things that, well, all the Buddhist centers I've been involved in over the years are always talking about how to build a sangha, the community. How do we connect with one another? And I think that is something we all need to think about some and work on, is connecting with one another, building a community, caring for one another. But so much of our economy now does depend on international trade, exchange of ideas all over the world. Our president doesn't seem to have a great understanding of that, but I don't want to go there. Somehow, every time I'm up here, I wind up mentioning him. But he is something that really kind of concerns how our world is working and how we're working in it. So, but really, more than any time in history, we depend on stuff from all over the world, ideas and goods. We'll talk a little bit more about this later in the talk, and really kind of dealing with that in a more visceral way. But right now, His Holiness talks a little bit about the disconnect of all the information we get and our lack of emotional engagement with that. And in some ways, you know, he says that our way of living, our way of being, has not caught up with our understanding. All the stuff we get from the internet, we haven't quite figured out how to really live with that in a skillful way. He's not against the internet or communication. At one point, he even says, like so many other people, he likes cat videos. But one of the things he points out is that so much of the internet stresses the difference between us and them. And that is one of the problems. And if you read the papers, some of the things we have been reading about some of the Nazi movements, the hate groups, things like that, people get online and they find a community there that is filled with that, kind of putting out the differences between us and them and creating a them and othering people, I think is what some of the academics like to talk about. So we kind of have to get past that. We have to really realize just what we all have in common. We have to kind of realize that looking at all the anomalies, the differences, just really isn't all that skillful. And the differences between us and other people, and, you know, you look at some people living in different parts of the world, they really do live very different lives from us. They really do seem very different. And many of us couldn't imagine living the way they live, like in some places in Africa or Southeast Asia. And yet, really, as the Dalai Lama has pointed out a number of times, the Karmapa repeats several times in this book, we are all alike in that we all basically want to be happy, and we also all basically do not want suffering. And I think everybody really kind of has those same basic motivations to find some sort of happiness, to avoid suffering. So with the internet, the possibility of all the communication technology, we really can move closer. We can explore how other people live. We can reflect on that and kind of bring it more home and really start to understand that they are pretty much the same as us in what they want. He also points out some of the challenges of online communication, the lack of the nonverbal cues that we depend on in conversation, things like that. You know, and there was a study a few years ago about people that watched a lot of television. And this is about their social lives in general, people's social lives. People that watched a lot of television thought they had or reported having a much more active social life than they did. Their friends were friends, I mean on TV. That came out when that show was still on, Friends. And it's kind of, you know, a little bit easy to get into that, to think about Zaray or some of the characters on there. Well, you kind of feel like you know them. In some ways, you were part of that little group. Even though they don't know you, you don't know them. They're just little images on a screen. And yet that somehow gives us a sense of connected with something. But it's not real. It's virtual. And ultimately, it is not satisfying, which is why I think so many people do feel lonely. And as he points out, the internet will never give you a hug. You need sometimes to really have a real person in front of you to talk to respond to interact with. So even though that world can be absorbing, ultimately it is illusory and it's not very satisfying. We're in danger of losing touch with our own inner resources for living interdependently and our capacity to be present and feel authentic closeness to others. And that's something we really need to work on, getting back in touch with. And I think probably most of you do live probably somewhat authentically. You're all here, and I see everybody getting together for coffee and chatting. So, you know, that's good. And that is, I think, helpful. He also writes about the overwhelming amount of information we have, all the access to all the information. And that makes it hard to really shift from the intellectual to the emotional. We know too much, we have so much information. Sorting it out and turning it into what's really useful, what will really help our lives, is something of a challenge. So we need to find some way to really go deeper, not just skim the surface. What he calls is, we can make our lives light, I guess low-calorie, not meaningful. And while the tech can actually enrich our lives, it can also be using us. You know, I guess the purpose of Facebook and some of those other things, what they're really marketing and what they make their money on is our attention. That's kind of what they really want, is our attention. They really don't really want us to connect with one another. Well, they give us that illusion and we feel like we do. But they want our attention so they can sell us stuff. So we need to pay attention to how we use the internet and learn to use it wisely, skillfully. As he points out, happiness doesn't come from all the things around us. It's only found within us and can emanate from there. So we don't need to live virtual lives, we need to live actual lives. And I guess that's part of his whole point, is having an actual life, a real life. And a lot of people, he says, apparently people he talks to and come to him for help, talk about just feeling disconnected, even though they're acting online. And it's a natural thing for those of you that have grown up with it. I'm still getting the hang of it. I'm an old guy. But but they also feel it's very dissatisfying. And, you know, I've seen some people, you know, they're communicating with one person and they want to communicate with somebody else. You know, while they're talking to somebody on the phone, they want to get on Facebook and check how somebody else is doing, or the instant messaging. And he talks about the way people communicate by texting. Families rarely have time to get together for dinner and eat together, and sometimes they even just communicate by text rather than actually talking to one another. So, this is not very a satisfying way to live. And yet, we do that. And then he talks about his life growing up on the Tibetan plateau, where they had no electronics, they had no electricity. They kind of lived with nature, with the rising and setting of the sun. Their workday was based on the demands that the animals that they were caring for demanded. And when they had something to do, they did it. And when they had nothing to do, they could be together and enjoy each other's company, have tea, talk, tell stories, make up stuff. And he thought that was a great life in many ways. You know, it was a very simple life, very natural life, but it was more in tune. And I guess some ways this is not a new thing. I'm reminded by a few lines of a Wordsworth poem that was probably written around the early 1800s. Something about the fact that getting and spending, we lay waste our powers. The world is too much with us late and soon. And the poem goes on to talk more about getting back in touch with nature. So that goes way back with the whole beginning of the technological age, the industrial age. And yeah, he talks a little bit about the shallowness of the online relationships and how it can really feel kind of distressing to notice you have 500 Facebook friends and you're really feeling lonely. You know, I have several bunch of Facebook friends, and I've even met some of them. But and in a little refreshing section in this chapter that I rather like, he gets very personal about his life. He entitles that section, Introducing His Loneliness. People call him His Holiness, he says, but in some ways it'd be more accurate to call him His Loneliness. As the reincarnation of a 900-year-old being, he is got lots of expectations laid on him. He is surrounded by many people, sees people all day, talks to them, but he really can't have friends. You know, he doesn't have anybody that says, hey, Trinley, let's go down and have a drink. Let's hang out. I mean, that just isn't the way his life can work. His internet accounts, he's on the internet, but he has people that do that for him. You know, he has followers, he gets likes, but he really doesn't get friends. And he uses that to talk a little bit about the expectations that we have for other people and the expectations people have on us that are often a little bit unrealistic. You know, we meet people and we somehow form opinions of them. And they have expectations of us and expect us to behave in a way. And some of us really kind of buy into that and start marketing ourselves when we're on Facebook. You know, some people have commented about how happy and great lives all of her Facebook friends are having. But nobody points, you know, to really the bad stuff in their life and how unhappy they are. They point out, they talk about the good stuff. You know, they send pictures of happy vacations, all the wonderful things they're doing, not the nights they spend alone at home looking at TV or drinking too much. So we need to pay attention to that too, of what we're really doing to ourselves and to other people. One of the old Zen teachers has a little saying. The Zen guys have such great little sayings. I love them. Not knowing is most intimate. And that kind of gets to this point. It takes a few minutes to think about just what he means by that. But really, if you just kind of look at somebody as not knowing them and just being with them, allowing them to present themselves as they are. That leads to the way to real intimacy, real connection. I hope that makes some sense. And that's a good little saying to kind of contemplate. When I first heard it, it took me a while to really get it, but I do think it's good. So, yeah, he talks about for being such a holy and exalted personage. You know, it's he just can't go out and find friends. And, well, his situation is unique, as I just talked about. In some ways, it applies to all of us. He also points about the other thing that leads to a lot of our loneliness and isolation is our need to be independent. You know, sometimes I think of that as a Lone Ranger syndrome. You know, I grew up with a Lone Ranger. I'm not sure if you know him, but, you know, he was this masked man that rode into town, saved the day, and rode out, and they always asked, who was that masked man? It was the Lone Ranger. But, you know, nobody knew him. Well, he had one companion, Tonto, the loyal Indian friend. But you know, I think a lot of us kind of have that fantasy that they can just ride into town, save the day, and ride off and be totally unknown. And that's a real fantasy. But I think that is somehow describes a lot of at least American men, how we relate to the world. We're often very not comfortable asking for help. We really do want to be independent. You know, for several years I was volunteering as a chaplain in a hospital in Santa Fe. And, you know, a lot of people, you know, they were kind of in there alone. They had friends. But they really didn't want to ask anybody for help. They just wanted to be independent. And yet I talked to friends of some of these people and other people. And they really want to help. They feel disappointed they're not allowed to. It's kind of the gift of helping that many people want to give, want to help, and we want to deny them that. So I guess learning to take help gracefully is something we need to think about. Karmapa talks a little bit about how Tibetans really do appreciate help. You know, if you help an older person, he just says thank you. He's very appreciative. I knew one guy that was in his 70s and looked very frail, but was actually pretty sturdy. And somebody wanted to help him, and he practically wanted to knock him down. But didn't want help. I can do it. So we need to be aware of that, too. Both of our own motivations of trying to help, to be helpful, and being willing to ask for and accept help when we need it. You know, one of the things in one of the bodhisattva vows, I guess more in the Gelupa tradition I read about, is a bodhisattva is supposed to accept gifts. They don't necessarily need them. But you can't be generous and you can't give if you have nobody to give to. So that's an important thing to contemplate. And when you really start to realize in your interconnectedness, you really will understand you're really never alone. You are part of this whole thing. So the next thing he really talks about is partly on building on this a little bit. And where it really begins is learning to understand your own basic goodness. To stop being your own enemy, as he puts it, coming in from the cold. Sometimes, you know, we kind of cut ourselves off and then wonder why. And yet, if we really practice, you know, some of the teachings in this and loving kindness practice, Tonglen, we begin with ourselves. And we really kind of have to begin with developing a good relationship with ourselves, of loving ourselves, caring for ourselves, bringing out our Buddha nature, this basic goodness. And this will help you to deal with the unhealthy attitudes and habits that many of us have. This is what underlies so much of our practice, is overcoming some of these negativities, these bad habits, and really developing what's positive in us, connecting with our Buddha nature. just wholeheartedly nurture your positive qualities. And this will literally add a quality of warmth and richness to your time alone. You can experience connection, even if you are alone with other people. You know, and I found that when I've been on retreats, just doing a lot of metta practice, loving kindness practice, you really do feel like you are part of something, even though you're not really interacting with anyone. But you know people are there, and they're caring, and you're caring, and you're reaching out to them in ways. So if you learn to delight in these good habits and good-hearted feelings, you know, you'll feel better. You'll be heartened by them. And you have more than anyone else the resources to warm yourself from within. It's something that, you know, we really can't do. Or someone can't do it for somebody else. And we do have this natural capacity for closeness. It's not anything new to us. Children seem to do it just rather automatically. You put a bunch of toddlers together, and they usually start making friends right away, interacting, connecting. And it is such a natural thing. And he even talks about an elevator study. It was kind of fun to talk about. You know, we get on an elevator, we're going down with other people, and we're just sort of staring at the front, not interacting with anyone. They put chimpanzees on the elevator. And when it stopped, when another chimp got on, they were so excited to see another one of their kind. They immediately started interacting with each other, having fun. It might be good if we were able to do that. At least smile and say hello, or acknowledge the presence of another, and not be so isolated. Try to connect a little bit. You know, it's kind of walking down the street. You know, I'm working more and more at just saying hi to people, just as a general practice, just trying to connect a little more. And some people appreciate it. Some people kind of look like, what are you, some sort of weirdo? But you do it anyway, you know, and it's just trying to be kinder and reaching out. Reflecting on our independence and consciously training ourselves to identify at work in our lives allows us to cultivate an awareness of others as a part of us. And one of the practices, and this is something of a Buddhist practice, but it's, you don't have to really be Buddhist to practice it, is recollecting the kindness of others. And this is something we can all work on. You know, just throughout our day, at the end of the day, just kind of reflect at all the things you've benefited from. You know, the guy that lets you in traffic when you want to change lanes. You know, that was a kindness. And just kind of acknowledge that, feel grateful for it. Cultivate this attitude of gratitude. Call to mind where all the things that you have in your life come from. You know, our clothing comes from all over the world. Think about the people that made it. Even suggest, like, reading the labels. Where is this from? Maybe even learning a little bit about it. A number of years ago, I was in Thailand. It was the first time I was there. And I was walking down a little back street and walking by some shops, and I could see all these young women sewing together clothes that many of them would wind up in our markets in this country. They looked happy enough, but they probably weren't making very much money. They were probably living, you know, 5, 10, 12 in a room. But it was better for them than living in the country. At least they thought so. They thought I was kind of a strange-looking thing, stopping and looking in at them. Got a kick out of that. But if you kind of think about this and how we are connected, where our stuff comes from, who made it and how, kind of maybe even investigate, he suggests, some of the conditions they live under. And that might inspire you a little bit to maybe do something about it. Get a little bit involved in some of the social action on fair trade. You know, also a few years ago, we were in Asia and traveled around, and I got to see rice being grown and harvested in pretty much all of its stages. And it just, I keep saying this, but really, we don't pay enough for our food. These people, some of them are just living in huts, If they have electricity, it's a light bulb dangling from the ceiling, run off of a battery. They have to take the battery down the road to some guy that has a charger every so often to recharge it and give him a few cents, whatever the currency is, or trade a few pounds of rice. But, you know, this is their life. And this is how they live. And yet they're growing a lot of the food that we get in this country. And it's hard work. You know, had the opportunity to play like we were rice workers and get in the paddy. And the woman, you know, gave me her scythe, her sickle. And cutting the rice wasn't easy. It's a skill you have to develop and takes a lot of practice. So let's just kind of think about those kinds of things and where stuff comes from, who makes it, how it gets here, what the chain is, how these people are living their lives, and start feeling more connected to this world, and that these people are pretty much like us. They just really want to be happy. They want to avoid suffering, and they want a better life. As you think about all the benefits, you know, you really just need to develop a good attitude of gratitude. And I think that is an important thing to kind of work at all the time, is just being grateful. You know, in The Great Path of Awakening, the Lojong slogans, one of Lama Kathy's favorite books, one of the slogans is, be grateful to everyone. And I think that is an important one, just having that sense of gratitude. Even the people that give you a hard time. I mean, you may want to just kind of get mad at them, but how can you really practice patience if everybody is nice and does things the way you want? I mean, that's how you develop. You know, you need some of these little, irritants? I guess to use the image of a pearl, that's how a clam or oyster grows its pearl, is from a little irritant that gets in there. And that's what it takes to really develop some of our skills and understanding. So if we have these difficult people in our lives, we can just appreciate them and be grateful because they do offer us the opportunity to practice, to work at the skill of being grateful, having gratitude. And as you develop that idea of being grateful, you find you really start to feel better. It's a nice feeling to feel grateful. You feel good. So kind of pay attention. Where does stuff come from? Where does your food come from? Who made it? Is there something you can do? I mean, some of this he does really get into, of developing this, and it's supposed to lead with this kind of deepened awareness to possibility of action, that you may be able to do something about these lives. And when the prices go up in the grocery store, just kind of hope that maybe some of the people making it, growing it, are actually getting paid a little better, that their lives are being improved. You can look for companies that have ethical labor practices and try to support them and buy from them. In some ways, I'm a little conflicted on some of this, of really trying to boycott some of these companies, because if we don't buy this stuff, the people making it, even under bad conditions, would have no way to make a living. And so there's lots of little rubs on this that just kind of make all kinds of these things complicated. So it should result in some sort of action. He talks about a little bit the kindness of animals, feeling close to animals, nature, the earth. As he said in the first chapter, nature is not just scenery. We are a part of it. And we need to kind of think about that too, the environmental devastation we have caused, how we treat animals, kind of encouraging vegetarianism, the way that the animals we raise for our meat are treated, kind of the cruel conditions there. Give that some thought. You know, we have a lot more awareness of that in general now. I think I just saw today that somewhere that you won't see that doggy in the window anymore so much because of those puppy mills are being more regulated and closed down. And a lot of them were kind of raised and bred under pretty harsh conditions. So And, of course, the Envire movement is coming a very big thing and a very important thing and a very critical thing. Read more and more every day about global warming, climate change. Glaciers are melting much quicker than they thought they would be. The Antarctic ice shelf is collapsing a little more rapidly than some people thought it would, with possibly catastrophic results. Some of you younger people may really be suffering from that. I probably won't be around for the worst of it, but it's already beginning. Some of this hot weather that we're having, well, it's not unusual for this time of year. It's still a little warmer. What's going on in Europe, where it's like 110 in France, is just kind of incredible. So this has a lot of things to do with the global climate change, with what we're doing to the environment. So we kind of need to pay attention to that. The way we use plastics. If you eat fish, you probably are eating plastic. The seas are full of them, and it dissolves in there, and all these little plastic microparticles get in them, and they become part of us. And nobody quite understands what the consequences of that are, if any. So as we cultivate a broader awareness of these chains of causality that link us to others, and cultivating the feeling of closeness that can inspire us to act, and let's hope we do start doing a little more active, making this a little more conscious, a little more aware. So those are the key things I wanted to go over, and I was hoping we could have a little bit of a discussion about all of this. I think the microphone is up over there if somebody wants to ask a question or make a comment.
Hi, Jim.
Hi.
So I was hoping that you could talk a little bit about the degree to which the idea of karma is really just an explanation of literal interconnectivity between the actions and the things that you do, or just interconnectivity between people, and less of maybe a magical force of cosmic justice. Mm-hmm. Could you elaborate a little bit on how karma is connected to interconnectivity?
Yeah, I think that's a good question, a good thing to think about. Yeah, karma, there's nothing really mystical about it. Actions have consequences. It's as simple as that. So if you do some kind of action, then there are consequences to that. And that does ripple through everything. You know, a few years ago, there was a book out on chaos theory, you know, on the butterfly effect, the little butterfly flapping its wings in China. 10 years ago gave us the hurricane we have brewing now in the Atlantic. Things are so connected, and any action has some sort of consequence. And the other thing about karma is that thoughts are actions. What you think is an action. Now, there's the whole thing on what makes a complete karma. It's having the thought, doing the action, having a result, and enjoying or rejoicing in the result. It makes a complete karma. But even a little bit of it has some effect. It doesn't have to go all the way there. Plotting to hurt somebody is a negative thing, and you know, to make it complete, you'd have to actually do it. They'd actually have to be hurt, and you'd have to say, great, I did it. But just having that thought kind of opens the way to that. And starts changing the way you respond. So, yeah, it is connected, and in a very subtle way, that's a good thing to think about. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it does. Thanks, Jim.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I didn't know you went to Thailand. You said it was Thailand?
I was in Thailand twice. Then we did a trip through Thailand, Laos, Vietnam, and Cambodia.
Yeah, on a news program once I saw where in Kenya, there's some entrepreneurs selling these solar power units.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a panel about this big that somebody just puts on their hut. Mm-hmm. and they can recharge a phone and mm-hmm. maybe get some internet. Mm-hmm. And it's not, you know, you can't run a wash machine and stuff like that, but
no, we've seen
those. I was
those.
Really impressed when I saw that. Mm-hmm.
No, we're seeing more and more of that. And we did see a number of solar panels in some of these more simpler houses in Southeast Asia. It is coming to be a part of their life. It does replace the guy down the street with a generator and charger.
Yeah.
And but they still can't really run. I'm not sure they can get the internet off of that, but they, well, maybe they can get it on their phone. A lot
they,
of these...
if they... In some areas, if they had like, it doesn't take much power to run like an iPad or a small laptop, and then, mm-hmm. And then they'd have like a hotspot thing,
mm-hmm.
and well, that's dependent on a microwave tower not too mm-hmm. far away.
Yeah,
but, and I was really impressed when I saw mm-hmm. that.
Yeah, now we're seeing more and more of that, and I think. Yeah, solar power, that kind of thing, will be one of the ways that some of these third world countries will be developed. And I guess they have whole economies now kind of based on exchanging money through their cell phones. I'm not quite sure how that works, but they allow that. Hi.
Hi. My name's Ray.
Ray?
Ray, yeah. I was also just reflecting, this is probably more a comment, but just sort of reflection for me on, like, I feel like with the internet and interconnection, one of the things that, like, particularly like marginalized, like trans, queer, people of color have talked about is how much connection has actually been offered by things mm-hmm. like Twitter or Facebook, mm-hmm. that it's offered the opportunity to connect when there is utter isolation within predominantly white institutions or mm-hmm. sanghas where there's no other true trans or queer folks and stuff. Mm-hmm. So I feel like it's interesting because I feel like it could go on either end where if you consume too much and mindlessly and without being embodied, mm-hmm. it could still reinforce that isolation.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I feel like, especially since everything that's been going on around like sexual violence within our communities, that mm-hmm. it's been a really important space for women and other embodied people to mm-hmm. like think through mm-hmm. what their experience is like when sometimes in our sanghas, those either experiences or ways of understanding power are not mm-hmm. there. So I'm looking forward to thinking more about the complexities of technology and how it can be both challenging and painful, mm-hmm. but also helpful as well. So
yeah, well, that's good. Yeah, no, the Karmapa talks about using the internet wisely. Mm-hmm. You know, he talks about both sides of it and having these internet communities that are positive and do bring people together. He would, I think, be among the first to admit mm. it's a good thing. Mm. I know a lot of people have found the Dharma by searching on the internet for it. Mm. But then they show up at places like this and see real people. But yeah, no, it is a great thing. And it does create a sense of community and a way of connecting with people. And if you're a little outside the mainstream, it is a good way to find your people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think, though, that there's also complexity around like when we show up, right? Because even though we're showing up, we're also showing up as people of different identities. Like, mm-hmm. so that like there was a really good article I would recommend in Tricycle about being brown in a sangha and the ways that like teachings can reinforce whiteness or othering, you know. Mm-hmm. Or I wrote a piece in Lion's Roar about being trans in Buddhist communities and how painful that can be. And so I think there's complexity around, as you're saying, not just the internet, but also as we come together. Mm-hmm. as we are in the present moment, and how challenging and also possible or hopeful that can be. So,
yeah, thank you for that. Yeah, and those are really important things to think about and important issues that we really need to deal with and work with more. Hi.
Hi. Yeah, so like on karma, I just had a few things I wanted to say. Like, I used to be that fiercely independent American male. And since I started practicing meditating, I've noticed that people have been outwardly kind to me. Like, you know, I was unloading a truck at my job and somebody offered to help bring in the stuff. And, like, you know, just having that. And, you know, like, it was off-putting a little bit for me to start accepting these things coming my way. And, you know, gradually I just worked my way into it. But like, you know, and being accepting of all beings is definitely important into the gay trans thing. And, you know, like, I was reading in one of the Buddhist books to venerate, you know, everybody as your spiritual teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I spent some time in jail, and there was a man in there who was 23, but he had the mental capacity of a 10-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. he told me to try to connect more with my brother, who's got a mental handicap.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I took those words at faith, and I've been talking to him, you know, a lot more often and trying to connect more with my brother. So, like, this has been a complete turnaround for me, and I love it.
Very good. I'm glad to hear it. Right. I've done a lot of work in jail as a chaplain Buddhist teacher, and yeah, and it's good that you found the Dharma. And you're really taking one of my lines. Many of you that have had my meditation classes have heard me say, when I started to meditate, people became nicer.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
My question for you is, do you think that thoughts are actions?
Thoughts are action?
Yeah, are thoughts actions?
Yeah, they are.
Hmm.
Yeah, one of the texts on karma begins, karma is movement of the mind, a thought.
Okay. And so one thing I have to ask about that is, like, I feel like sometimes, like, you know, being someone who hasn't really quite tamed my mind, I have a lot of thoughts that are very, like, not intrusive in a way, you know, like, I'm blessed to be, like, relatively mentally healthy, but sometimes I do have, like, you know, my mind's in the gutter, or it's just like, you know, I think bad thoughts about my friends or just people that I know. I can be like critical or, and it just seems to like come in and like, then I just kind of let it go. But I think that's something that, I think disturbs me sometimes. So I don't know if you have much to say about that, but
welcome to my mind. No, I think we all have that. And the thing is as we notice these thoughts that aren't skillful, that aren't good, to acknowledge we have them and to let them go and to try to change them, try to replace them.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you can just acknowledge the thought and just let it go. And sometimes you have to really work at thinking something more positive.
Yeah.
Sometimes it'll be persistence. I think in one of the suttas, the Buddha says something as, like, as a strong man would take a weaker man and crush his head. Take the thought and crush it.
Oh, my God. That's hard to do.
Yeah. Well,
especially
it is.
If your thought's already a little bit aggressive. Like, if you're, like, already kind of pissed off, and then you're, like, it's hard to, you know, some thoughts are really easy to kind of let go of, but I feel like others are just, like, they just keep coming back and very intensely. So then it's like I feel crazy and I just want to run around. I don't know what to do.
You know, just kind of look at that and try to work with letting it go, kind of realizing these are not skillful thoughts, and try to practice that with more skill. Also, to keep up a basic meditation practice and Tonglen or loving kindness will work at beginning to change your mind too, so that you'll have less of those thoughts.
Okay.
And then cultivating a sense of gratitude for the good things that come to you. All of that will help just kind of slowly but definitely change your mind in a way that will be more skillful and for the better.
Thank you.
Does that help?
Oh, yeah, of course.
Good.
Thanks.
Anything else? Well, I think we have wound things up. I'm not sure I have anything more to add. And if there's no more questions, we'll just sit quietly for a moment and be grateful for having the center here and these teachings, and dedicate the merit that all beings may find their way to enlightenment and well-being. So let's just sit for a moment or two. So thank you all for coming and for being here. and for listening to me ramble. So thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this week's Dharma Talk. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes. To learn more about the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling or to donate to support our Dharma Talk series, please visit our website at columbusktc.org. The opening and closing music for the podcast is Tibetan Flute Song by Tamding Arts at tamdingarts.com. Please join us again next week for another Dharma Talk.